Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Longevity Post podcast number 4. I'm your host, Scott Chaveri. With me, as always, is the infamous immortal hair himself, Brian Simonis. Brian, what's up?
Great. How are you doing today?
I am fantastic, as always. Today's inspirational quote of the day: all truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. Third, it is accepted as being self-evident. Arthur Schopenhauer. All right, Brian, so this is our fourth podcast. So just a quick recap on the first three. We went through the Immortal Hair supplement regimen. We talked about, I think in the second podcast, we talked about how heavy metals toxicity can impact hair loss. And in the third podcast, we got into dietary interventions. We talked a little bit about glyphosate, non-gluten, celiac sensitivity. And so for the fourth podcast, what I wanted to talk about was, let's say everybody's doing everything right. So everybody has listened to the first three podcasts. They're taking all the supplements. They're doing everything right dietarily. They have no heavy metal issues. They're eating all organic, they're avoiding GMOs, they're avoiding glyphosate. Everything that we talked about, they're doing perfectly. And they're still, for some reason, their hair is suffering. So what I want to talk about is what are some of the other things that could be happening that might be driving hair loss that we haven't talked about yet?
Yeah, Scott, so this is going to be an ongoing discussion, I think, because there's frankly a lot of hidden avenues or hidden kinds of inflammation or something that's happening in your body that might be unique or unique to your biochemistry that just inexplicably is causing your hair loss or some other physical problem that just no one can really account for. And maybe you've had a litany of blood chemistry tests. You've been to several physicians and no one's really given you a clear answer. So today I think we're going to get into a little bit of a discussion called methylation and how that affects maybe your hair and maybe your health.
Okay, so methylation, I've heard of it. Do you have a high-level explanation of what it is and why it might be a problem?
Okay, so people usually say, well, what exactly is methylation? What does it really mean? And sort of a real quick short thing is that a methyl group is simply one carbon atom connected to three hydrogen atoms, and it may be written as CH3 with the three being a subscript. Now, forget about that part. What does it really mean? It means that if you are not methylating properly, it could affect your ability to produce what's called antioxidant enzymes, such as glutathione, which allows your liver to detoxify, you know, various pollutants, environmental estrogens, you know, all kinds of things, heavy metals. Also, it could affect your ability to make happy neurotransmitters. It could affect your mood. It could cause anxiety, it could cause depression, it could cause insomnia, and more importantly, it might affect your hair, which is what we're talking about today.
Okay, so you're not methylating, so you're not making enough glutathione, and glutathione is known as the master antioxidant, something your body makes on its own, and which helps the liver. I mean, your liver is your main detoxification organ, so it helps your liver detoxify all of the toxins that are in your system. So you're saying not methylating properly, not detoxing properly. Is that the connection?
Yes, and I would add also that your skin is considered the largest eliminative organ. So within your skin, including your scalp, you're going to have a certain reservoir of glutathione. And unfortunately, in a lot of chronic disease, or maybe you can call it a low level of chronic inflammation, let's say hair loss or a skin problem, your ability to produce glutathione in that local area, whether it's the lungs or maybe you've got a condition such as hair loss, or it could be rosacea or psoriasis or something. Your ability to produce glutathione in local skin could literally affect that issue. So how do you produce more of that glutathione? That's that master antioxidant, as you, Scott, were saying, and that's just really powerful.
So I think we were saying before we started recording that people with male pattern baldness had 30% less glutathione in their scalps than those that aren't losing their hair. Was that Did I get that right?
That's absolutely correct. So it's absolutely true. So imagine this is, if you think about it, oxidative stress is one commonality between us, balding people, if you will. So yeah, our follicly challenged people, if you want to get politically correct, have less glutathione, 30% less glutathione in scalp skin. So.
Interesting. Okay, so getting back to methylation. So methylation problems, less glutathione, liver struggles, also lower neurotransmitters. That's interesting. So is it all of them? Is it serotonin, dopamine? Is it kind of across the board?
Yes, it is across the board. So, great example. So let's say with someone is taking an SSRI, serotonin reuptake inhibitor, such as Prozac or Zoloft or what have you. If they do have a methylation problem, not to say that all of these people do, I mean, we are different. If they take something that enhances the methylation cycle or process, they might actually allow to not only get off of their antidepressant medication, but also they can even enhance its effect. That can be very useful for people. Why not correct the underlying problem?
All right, interesting. Okay, so, all right, so we talked a little bit about some of the consequences of having a methylation issue. So can you help me with the hair loss connection a little bit more? Is it really just a detox issue, or is it more complicated?
It might be a little bit more complicated. For example, the neurotransmitters you mentioned. If you think about it, if you can't sleep through the night, or if you have raging anxiety, or your thought processes are just going a million miles a second, you just can't settle down at night, you can't rest. That's not going to drive you crazy. It's not going to be good for your hair. And if you don't have a sound sleep at night, when you're sleeping, that's your restoration process. People who don't really have a complete, full, deep sleep, especially in the deeper stages of sleep, they're going to have a full reparation or regeneration of your body. So that's going to really result in elevation levels of cortisol, which is your fight or flight response hormone. And if you just have that going on, that alone is going to upset your biochemistry and be more difficult to maintain hair there. Also, if your mood is not optimal, if you're not making the happy neurotransmitters, whether it's dopamine, serotonin, or what have you, or maybe you have an excess amount of epinephrine, norepinephrine, things that are sort of putting you on edge, and you've got this constant sense of tightness in the chest and sense of agony and doom. That's going to affect your hair too. So it's very psychosomatic, including, it's just not a thought or imagined process. It's physical translates into the psychosomatic or the imagine because it's really happening. You just don't feel normal. You don't feel well. You don't feel content.
Okay, interesting. Very interesting. Okay, so it is kind of amazing to me when we talk about these things. Like you wouldn't think necessarily that, let's say, the inability to detoxify and anxiety and stress, like those things seem kind of separate processes, but they could have like the same a similar root cause, what you're saying, or the same root cause, right?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Scott, because the pharmaceutical industry loves to create new customers. And one of the marvelous ways they do this, not just through marketing and think tanks, is they think, how do we characterize or classify different conditions, different mood behaviors, as if they're different, separate disorders.
Right.
So they have something called the Diagnostic Statistical Manual called a DMS-IV. They're always updating it. It's probably now the Diagnostic Statistical Manual Part 5. So they're always updating it. So they're always classifying new conditions, ADD, ADHD, depression, anxiety, social anxiety disorder, and they're always coming up with new ones. How can we create a new drug for this said condition and treat it as if it's some specific disorder? When in reality, it could be an underlying issue on some detoxification defect that if you simply correct, you might resolve the actual problem and resolve not just that condition, maybe a whole litany of other hidden conditions that you just didn't resolve
Right,
until
right,
then.
right. Yeah, okay. I mean, that makes perfect sense. I mean, as you and I have talked in the past, right? Like, treating symptoms is a lot more profitable. Treating symptoms in perpetuity is a lot more profitable than solving the underlying problem once and for all, right? That's not very profitable. Okay, so So how does somebody know? I think we touched on this a little bit, but so how does somebody know if they have a methylation problem?
That's a great question. And in fact, this is, I might even take a back step and just explain how some people think they know how to fix this problem. So sometimes people are going to look at different tests like 23andMe, which is a genetic test profile that looks at different gene expressions. And they might look at MTHFR or something that might look into, are certain genes sort of hedged to behave a certain way affecting your methylation cycle. The problem with these tests is that it might lead you down a false flag. It might imply that, oh, you've got these genetic defects here. But the truth is, there might be other areas in that gene sequence that might be already overcompensating. Some people might not have a methylation problem. They might have an over-methylation problem, which is another subject. But suffice to say, one of my favorite ways to detect a methylation problem is to run your histamine level. And histamine is sort of an inflammation or an allergy response thing. Another thing people could do that's not quite as reliable, they can look at a homocysteine level.
So are these both blood tests, histamine and homocysteine? You would go get blood test.
Yes.
And is it time of day doesn't matter with this, or does it have to be fasted? Would it be run as part of a panel, or would you have to go to your doctor and say, I don't know
You
what
can
that is?
actually run it individually, and there's no fasting required, and it's simply a blood test. So if you have an elevated homocysteine level, that could suggest that you have a methylation problem, although it's not 100% conclusive. My favorite way is histamine. So if you have an elevated histamine level, this could suggest that you have a histamine problem. And this is sort of an interesting epidemic in of its own. They can explain why people have this curious itch, maybe a strange sort of inflammation or reaction to something they can't quite account for. And so that's a more reliable test, rather than getting all these fancy gene sequences and trying to determine, this
So,
whole.
okay, so Brian, let me play devil's advocate though, because there could be other reasons that somebody would have elevated histamine level, right? So, I mean, is that enough to indicate to you that there's a methylation problem? Well, I mean, would you would because I'm still learning about the subject, but I did myself get the 23andMe test, and I did share it with you, and you did look at the results. So you're saying that that could lead you down, it could be a red herring, could lead you down the wrong path if that test is misread. The results of that test is misread. So you're saying
Yes.
histamine is better, getting the histamine tested is better, but is that enough? Is that a slam dunk if you have elevated histamine that you have a methylation problem, or could there be other factors, or what are your thoughts?
Okay. Well, the easy answer is I don't know. And to expand on that is I think it's easy to say and important to say that the level of biological complexity in the human body is just cannot be understated. So a lot of people have this idea that physicians or clinicians have some know-it-all type mentality. They don't know anything. I mean, quite honestly, they know just less than 1% of how the human body even works. And they're still unraveling the complexity. In fact, there's a number of paradigms and beliefs that have not completely been fleshed out, and they're assuming it's true and correct. So this is one problem. So I believe for the most part, for most people, the histamine is going to explain a lot, but it's not going to be the absolute clear answer for them. And what really muddies the issue a little is, are you in fact over-methylated or are you under-methylated? So there are people that exhibit symptoms of under-methylation, which is called hypomethylation. In other words, this methylation defect we're discussing. That may in fact be over-methylators. So what the histamine test is going to do is it might establish that you might be under-methylated, but it's not necessarily going to be 100% accurate. But I think it's easier to read, easier to interpret, rather than looking at these very fancy genetic profiles. So hopefully that answers the question.
It does. It does. Okay. So let's say, so actually, I'm just using myself as an example. I have had the 23andMe test done. You looked at my results. I didn't have I think it's the MTHFR mutation, or that would typically be in and of itself a red flag of a methylation problem. But I haven't had histamine and homocysteine levels tested. But let's say somebody did get their histamine and homocysteine levels tested and they were both elevated. So what would you do then? What's the next step?
Okay, well, the next step is, so if I understand you correctly, you said if you did a histamine test and a homocysteine test and those are both elevated, what would you do next? Well,
right.
That's a great question. So the answer was you might experiment, and I do say experiment. Really, ultimately, your body is the best determination of if something's going to work or not. So don't trust anyone, whatever you hear. Use your own body to sort of listen to it, right? So I would take or suggest something called methyl tetrahydrofolate. And what that is, they call it MTHFR for short. Methyl tetrahydrofolate, or what they call L5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. There's different forms of this. Sometimes they call it methylfolate, and for there's a patented form. There's also something called quadrifolate. So there's different forms of this, and basically it's an active form of vitamin B9, otherwise known as an active form of folate. Now, first I have to discuss what's the difference between folic acid, vitamin B9, which is synthetic, versus folate, versus the methyl tetrahydrofolate. So let's get into that first. So back in the 1940s, they, meaning scientists, synthesized what they thought was vitamin B9, and they called it folic acid. Unfortunately, most clinicians have never been taught the difference between folate and folic acid. Folate is real vitamin B9, has the full enzymatic activity. Its job is to help with DNA replication, dealing with the ability to produce glutathione, the ability to do many, many, many important functions in the body. When that's not working properly, a lot of things can go wrong. So getting back to the forms again, if you're getting into the special form, which is called the MTHFR or methyl tetrahydrofolate, this is 5 times more bioavailable than, say, your normal food-based folate, which is healthy and good. And the thing is if you have a methylation defect, your ability to use this synthetic stuff called folic acid, which is unfortunately in most low-grade supplements, it's not going to work in a person. Maybe you're going to have 20% usability of this stuff. Or in some people, maybe you can use 80% of it. Other people, it's working. If you take the synthetic B9 or folic acid, it might actually ruin or cause a defect when otherwise there never would have been a problem.
So just real quick, so why I find that fascinating is that I'm pretty sure that it's standard practice to recommend folic acid supplements to all pregnant women.
Yes, this is a problem. In fact, there has been some evidences where they'll look in and say, you know, there might be an increase of cancer, could be an increase of autism, it could be an increase of neurological deficits by introducing a synthetic form of folate known as folic acid. And this could actually cause some problems. Adding weight on that, you've got this stuff called bisphenol A, a well-known environmental toxin that the FDA has allowed to be in our food supply. It's normally found in the inside liners of cans and other things and plastics. And it takes just a super, super tiny amount to cause some real physiologic changes. 10 micrograms, 10 millionths of a gram is enough to create diabetes in a small animal. So that kind of gives you the weight of what a very powerful estrogenic compound your body doesn't know how to get rid of can affect you. And this could also pervert or derange the vitamin B9 or the ability to use it properly. And this could cause this genetic defect called the MTHFR, or methyl tetrahydrofolate polymorphism. So this is just, essentially, we are in a sea of toxins. And so this is a problem that could affect up to 50% of the population. And it's a hidden epidemic.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, so is the BPA, I mean, I've heard of BPA before. I try to use BPA-free plastics now that I'm aware of it. And very hard to find BPA-free canned goods, actually. You have to find some very I think Eden's Organics, don't quote me on that, folks, but I think that might be one that you can actually find that they use BPA-free can liners. But does the BPA, does it, if you have an MTHFR issue, does that make you more susceptible to BPA, or does the BPA cause an MTHFR issue? I wasn't
No,
sure about the linkage there.
yes, I would say it would cause it or exacerbate it.
Okay,
Also, to make
gotcha.
matters worse, a lot of BPA products, things that say BPA free, may contain a form of estrogen compound even worse than BPA itself. So
Come
I think it
on.
gets, yeah,
Right?
so it really,
What do
it,
you, what is that? Because now I'm gonna have to
yeah,
start
so
looking
it
up.
might be BPA C or BPA B or whatever. I don't really know the exact
Okay,
terms, but what
that's
they love to
fantastic.
do is by the time us, the herd, the public, whatever, once we get around to understanding what something does, they, the industry, just change it. Since that hasn't been really recognized in terms of what it does, no one's really catching on to it. So it's a trick. It's a
That's very sad. Sad, but I'm sure very true. Okay, so getting back, so you recommend that people take and geez, I won't even try to pronounce it, methyl tetrahydrofolate. Did I say that
Oh,
correctly?
that's fantastic for a first time. Yeah,
Okay, so
100% perfect.
the
That's
active form
perfect.
of vitamin B9. So, and is there a dosage? And then you said experiment with it because, the so my, I guess my question is, you said you can either under or over methylate. And so if you take this and you're not sure if you're under or over methylating, what should you, like, how should you kind of gauge your reactions? I mean, do you basically just listen to your body and see if you feel better? Is that a general recommendation?
Yeah, so this is a really good question. So I should really be, I'm going to try to be as specific as I can on this. So just to clarify a little bit, the MTHFR, or I should say the methyl tetrahydrolate, I can't even say it, methyl tetrahydrofolate, that form of the MTHFR form of folate is 5 times more powerful or more bioavailable. So if you're having a hard time really fully functioning, getting that full effect. See, when you're getting some folic acid in your diet or through food or through supplements, you're deranging this polymorphism. You're actually creating or contributing to it, not just the environmental estrogen. So when you're introducing this MTHFR form of folate, you're sort of bypassing that polymorphism. So you're kind of giving your body an opportunity to possibly improve its methylation process. Now, this is where the rubber meets the road, is that let's say you start taking 400 micrograms, a good starting dose. And I would suggest maybe trying this for 3 or 4 days. If you just start noticing just a gradual effect of mood changes, you just start feeling really good, very terrific on top of things. This is where you want to take a little bit of pause. Don't immediately jump to a higher dose. In fact, if anything, you want to just be very careful because sometimes after feeling pretty good for the first couple of days, you might be awaiting a massive wave of detoxification because all of a sudden the body can now metabolize sulfur compounds, which are things that help produce glutathione. All of a sudden, your body, for the first time in a while, can actually fully use its detoxification pathway. And when that happens, you're going to create a tidal wave of detoxification. You might just completely feel like you've been thrown under the bus. I mean, you're going to feel like you've been hit. You might get the flu. You might get something. So you want to sort of take a back, just put a little pause on it and make sure that you're not going to, mess yourself up. So be very, very careful and very conservative. On the other hand, if you take 400 micrograms for the first few days and you feel absolutely nothing, try increasing the dose to 800 micrograms. And try that and just very gradually increase it. Now, another caveat, maybe you don't have a polymorphism, maybe you're over methylated. If you are, you're actually going to start to feel bad. You're going to start to feel worse. This could suggest that this methylation problem is the other way around and you're an over methylator. So this is why you're going to be really careful and listen to your body and just decide the best you can if this is right for you.
Okay, that sounds very tricky to me, actually, because you're saying that you can feel bad if you are both an under or over methylator. If you're an under methylator, you can feel bad from a kind of a detox healing crisis, if you will. And then if you're an over-methylator, you can feel bad because now you're overdoing it and you're getting more than you need, essentially, right? So,
right. So just to interject real quick is normally what happens is if it's right for you, you're going to just start feeling really wonderful. You're going to be feeling really just, wow. I mean, almost elated. So what you do not want to do is you don't want to start upping the dose after that. What you really want to do is you might just stay at the same dose day after day. Be prepared to maybe something, you know, possibly going wrong. I'm not saying it's going to go wrong. It's just be prepared for it if it happens, especially if you graduate to a higher dose and then start feeling really wonderful. You might even decide to lower the dose just a little bit, just kind of test the waters there.
Okay. Okay. All right. And so what if you're an over-methylator? So obviously if you're an under-methylator, you take the B9, you feel better. Even if you have a little bit of a detox reaction, you get through that. And then you just, you know, continue taking the supplement and hopefully you feel great. But if you're an over-methylator, any suggestions on what you do there?
Yeah, so if you're an over-methylator, this is where you really want to stay away from methylated forms of B vitamins. So I'll give you an example. By the way, I should mention that folate also needs B12. So if you are a hypo or under methylator, B12 and folate really work sort of hand in hand. So it's a good idea to have some B12 in there as well. So that's something I should mention. So what about over methylation? So when these people, the reason they might feel bad if they're taking a methylated supplement is they're literally going to feel too much energy. And this usually is manifested as anxiety. So this is an interesting problem. So if you just feel like you're getting too much energy, unwelcomed energy, it's probably not right for you. So I would try to avoid the methylated forms of B12 and folate.
Okay. All right. That's interesting because we talked about earlier how one of the signs that you might have a methylation issue might be anxiety. So if you take it and you get even more anxious, it's probably not right for you. Okay.
Correct. Yeah. So this is where it gets a little bit complex because this is a situation where, you know, it's almost like you could be under or over and really manifest similar symptoms. And this really creates the muddy picture. But so this is why sometimes the testing might be important. So you're getting a little bit more of a clue that maybe you're doing the right thing rather than just taking a guess.
All right, that would be interesting. So you get the testing done. You try the supplements. If you feel better, maybe get tested again after taking the supplements for a while. And hopefully, if your histamine and homocysteine levels have gone down, then you know that you're doing something, you're doing the right thing. Okay. All right, Brian. Well, one other question that I had before we come up to the end of the show is, do you have a specific brand that you recommend? So you said, do you take this yourself, I guess? And also, is there a specific brand? I think Thorne makes a methylated form of B9, but I don't know if there's a specific brand. We have no relation to Thorne, by the way, but I don't know if there's a specific brand that you recommend that people take.
Right. Yeah, that's good. I actually do have the name of the kind I take, and you're right, Scott, it is called Thorne. It's Thorne number 12. Number 12. So under immortalhair.org, there is a section in there that talks about a regimen called the Male Pattern Baldness Regimen or MBP regimen, and you can look under it and see a link to find specifically what that type is. But yeah, you're right. It's, you know, not to say it's going to be the absolute best in the world, but it is definitely a methylated form of both B12 and folate.
Okay, and is it a B complex? It contains other B vitamins?
It does. In fact, that's a good question. Is you really want the whole B complex because it's not really an isolated thing where, oh, you need B6 or you need B3, you need riboflavin, you need B1. You really need them all together ultimately. So when you're taking a high dose of one specific thing, you really need the others. It could cause a deficiency in other B vitamins. So they really call them a B complex.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right, Brian. Well, coming up on the end of the show, so thanks again. Again, it's been a wealth of knowledge. I've certainly learned a lot in the past 29 minutes. So, folks, if you like the podcast, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also find out more information on immortalhair.org. You can click on the regimen page and you can see Brian's suggested regimen, but you can also register for the forum at immortalhair.org, and you can private message or ask questions right on the forum, and we can answer them right here on the podcast. You can also read some of Brian's brilliant articles at longevitypost.com, and you can also subscribe to the YouTube channel as well under Longevity Post. So Brian, thanks again. I think a quick preview of upcoming podcasts. We're going to talk a little bit about other hidden causes of hair loss, which such as mold and dental work. So stay tuned. We'll see you next time.
Subscribe to the channel. Thank you.